maybe the biggest domestic policy question is, where is the effort to cut taxes and reform the tax system headed?
We will totally eliminate the penalty on returning future earnings back to the United States, and we will impose a one-time low tax on money currently parked overseas so it can be brought back home to America where it belongs and where it can do its job.
How much of that can you realistically think is going to come back here?
It's all coming back because we're going to deem it. In the rules that we're writing, we're going to force you to pay the tax on it, whether you bring it back or not. We're going to have deemed that you had brought it back.
Whoa, that's kind of strong-arm tactics.
By removing loopholes or deductions and raising the standard deduction for everybody and lowering everyone's tax rates, we want to give every middle-income family in America a tax cut.
You know, I'm all in for cutting taxes. The one thing I've been vocal on is I want to make sure that we look at the details of the plan, that we make sure that the middle class is getting a tax cut and not a tax increase.
It's just one darn thing after another.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, economic growth was revised upward by the IMF this week, both for this year and next year, and the Japanese Nikkei breaks out of a two-decade decline, reaching an all-time record, as our markets also were in record territory this week. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to the Financial Sense News Hour. Joining me in Hour 1 will be Jonathan Krinsky, and he thinks there's nothing stopping this bull as the primary uptrends remain firmly in place. We'll be talking about that, what sectors of the market are most probable in the leadership that we're seeing in this market. Also, later on in the program, Mark Chandler will be joining me as we take a look at why the dollar has fallen. He thinks the dollar is bottom. He's going to tell you why, and also why the Japanese market is doing so well. After selling for several months, billions of dollars are coming back into the Japanese market. He'll be here as well. And also in the first hour, Ryan Poplava talking about what moved the markets this week. All of that coming up in Hour 1.
And I'm John Loeffler. You know, we've been telling you for quite some time that the stock market keeps hitting record highs, and it looks like it's going to keep going for a while. But one thing you need to know is about the concentration of risk. We talked about this last week. Five banks control 90% of the nation's deposits. Four banks control 93% of the derivatives. And five financial institutions control the majority of the nation's stocks and bonds and mutual funds. So we're obviously at some point or another going to see some kind of a blowout. There is downside risk you need to think about. But what about the melt up before the meltdown? That'll be the major part of the conversation going on the big picture today. And technology is changing rapidly and reshaping the economy and the world we live in. The world 10 years from now is not going to look like it does today. It's changing that fast. We're going to talk about the disruptors, those things that are disrupting the old way of doing things and creating an entirely new world. All of that coming up today on The Big Picture is part of the Financial Sense News Hour. But before we get on with all of the topics of the program, Ryan Poplava, welcome back this week for sharing with us some more of the drivers and catalysts investors were most interested in this week. Now, tell me, I could be wrong, but it does seem to me that the earnings were the big story this week with the start of the third quarter earnings season. And that seems to be kicking off all right, but not really stellar with the financials this week. JP Morgan Chase, Citigroup, Bank of America, and Wells Fargo. Penny, for your thoughts, let's start with that.
Yeah, the needle didn't move too much this week, John. If you look at how the markets closed, the S&P only closed up 0.15%. NASDAQ was only up almost a quarter of a percent, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average only closed up 0.43%. Decent week for Dow. I had some big stocks in it that carried. The financials were, as you mentioned, really the big bellwethers this week, and most of them beat. We got Citigroup, JP Morgan, both beat on revenues and earnings on Thursday. Then we had Bank of America and Wells Fargo on Friday. Bank of America beat. Wells Fargo did not. They missed. And a lot of that's based off of the legal settlement fallout from last year's sales practice scandal. When you look at it, the recent updated numbers around 3.5 million accounts, some opened with fictitious or unauthorized information. And so that's just a real big thing affecting them and their bottom line. Going into this earnings season, taking a step back here, looking at what we are going to be estimating and expecting for this earnings season, a FactSet, who we go to look for a lot of that data, estimates that the S&P's earnings will increase by about 2.8% this earnings season for the third quarter, which is down from the estimates of where they were at the beginning of the season, starting at 7.5%. So that's come down quite a bit. A lot of that was based off of a lot of the fears over insurance claims, based on all the hurricanes, all the damage that happened in the third quarter. And with those risks, you know, that puts the financial sector at the top of the risk list. But as you know, the sector rebounded very nicely from September. And that's based off of what we've seen happen to rates, looking at short-term and long-term rates, both went up quite a bit after Hurricane Irma got downgraded. You and I, we've talked all about that in September as things were developing. Economic numbers have also improved, so that helps the financials as well. That helps rates. So they benefit from that. So it's not surprising to see them kind of take a step back, even though they beat, you know, even though they beat on both earnings and revenues for three out of those four companies this week. You know, it's okay to see the sector kind of take a step back. It already had a nice run so far in the last month and a half. So to be expected. It should be interesting, though, to see how stocks react after earnings and this season based on some of the forward guidance we hear from management throughout the rest of the next few weeks. By the way, John, the most favored sector right now is the earnings sector. And that's because if you look at where earnings were a year ago, where they are expected to be this quarter, up almost 100% from a year ago. So right now, you know, financials are the concern. What's it going to do? The insurers, we'll hear from them in a week or two. And then on energy to see what happens to them based off of, that's also another sector that has done very well in the past couple of months. Much of a return based on prices have gone up, but also it's time to see the rubber hit the road on earnings.
So at least with the earnings season started, we may be delving into the industries and sectors of the market, identifying strong areas, whether the market trend should continue based on that. We also got a few economic reports this week, but just a few. So were there any that you thought of import to discuss today, Ryan?
Yeah, Friday and Thursday, those were two very big days for economic releases. Retail sales were a big plus for the market, up 1.6% in September. So these are September's numbers. And if we subtract autos, remember autos had a very good month. I forget if we talked about that last week. Auto sales have been up all because of, you know, what have they had to do? Replace all those autos that were flooded and destroyed from the hurricanes. So even without the autos, retail still up at a pretty good click, up about 1%. Inventories were also up about 0.7% in August, and that should be a big help on GDP estimates. You know, actually, I forgot to take a look at my typical indicator broadcast on GDP Now, the Nowcast from Atlanta Fed. I didn't take a look at it this week. I apologize. But looking at some other things, the other key numbers were on Thursday and Friday, the producer's price index on Thursday, and then the consumer price index on Friday. Recall last month, this was a big factor in what was going on with the markets, what was going on with rates and expectations toward the Fed. And I talked about it quite a bit, looking at Fed futures go from 30% probability of a rate hike in December all the way up to, we're currently around, I think, 81%. So a big jump when CPI figures came out last month. All right, to the numbers. The producer price rose about 0.4%, but a key component, you know, looking at the underlying factors, was final demand. That index rose 2.6% from a year ago, which that's the largest annual increase year over year that we've seen for final demand since February of 2012. So just to put things into perspective, finally, inflation numbers are starting to tick up. CPI also went up around 0.5% based a large part on energy. Energy prices are up year over year. That's looking at what's going on in CPI. The headline number that includes energy, that includes food, was up 2.2%. So up quite a bit. And recall last in August, it was up 1.9%. So it ticked up again, another month. That's, I think, 2 months in a row that we've seen a tick up in inflation now. But the core number, which is, of course, what the Fed looks at, was only up like 0.1% year over year, up 1.7%, where it's kind of been now about 5 months in a row. So it's kind of just sticking out there. And that's the number that the Fed's really looking at. Of course, also the PCE data. But anyways, looking at how we ended the week on the Fed futures contracts, I did take a look at that. The Fed is expected to raise in December with that, as I already mentioned, 81% probability chance. Slightly down from last week. Last week, we finished off at 87.8. So I'm not sure exactly what really factored into why that rate went down. But you know, it's just 6%, not a huge factor. But right now, it's still very high a probability that the Fed's going to go in December. But we still have, of course, October numbers, November numbers to see before that meeting. Things could change, but I don't think so. I don't think it's likely.
You know, speaking of rate raises, do you think the market is very concerned whether the Fed goes or doesn't go in December as far as another rate hike?
No, I don't think so at all. You know, we had the Federal Open Market Committee minutes come out on Wednesday. That was essentially all the notes and a real more detailed description of what was going on in the minds of the members when they voted last month not to go. You know, I think the Fed going in December, I think that's already priced in. You know, we've seen rates go up on 2-year treasuries, 10-year treasuries, both have gone up. But looking at more of that 2-year treasury, that's gone up since the beginning of September based on, again, the CPI data and economic results improving. And of course, you know, downgrading some of the damage estimates for Irma. And then also we had Nate come through. Of course, it affected some really key areas. Of course, we look at Puerto Rico without power, but there's not a whole lot of people in Puerto Rico. I don't think people realize it's just not a very big market. So it's not having that huge of an effect on the economy. Of course, it's affecting them, and I feel, you know, terribly badly. I imagine not having power for your refrigerators, your food, and it's just awful. But when you look at the grand scheme of things, is the market anticipating the Fed going in December? Yes, we've seen the probability numbers. Is it concerned? No. Again, I think we look at how the market reacted to the minutes being released on Wednesday, barely budged. So no, I don't think investors are really worried if the Fed is going to go. And I don't think they're going to get in the way of the economy right now. And stocks, for that matter, everyone seems to be anticipating that the Fed's not really that much of a factor. I think more of a factor going forward is, of course, let's see how the earnings season plays out. A lot of areas have moved up, and those are the key areas that, you know, need to really prove that the growth we've seen here is worthwhile based on earnings estimates and forward guidance. But I think more closely, look at Trump and Ryan and their tax reform bill. All eyes are on that. All eyes are on DC to put together a tax reform bill that can essentially pass underneath Trump's pen. We'll have to see. We have two different houses that are going to have to vote on this and put something together. Still a lot of compromising to do. And will the market move over the next month or so based on those compromises? And then also, how much of everything that Trump wants and what Ryan wants is going to actually get through? That's the key, I think, over the next quarter. So I don't think it's the Fed. I think it's DC.
Yeah, and I think you can make a good argument for that one as well. So anyway, this week, financial earnings pricing data details on the last Fed meeting showing that they intend to continue staying the course. And we'll look forward to hearing you talk about earnings season as it progresses next week. That seems to be the thing on the horizon. So obviously, the next few weeks are going to be the busiest for the announcements as well. Brian Poplava, look forward to seeing you again next week.
We'll talk to you then. Have a good weekend.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense News Hour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
I think at this point, a tax cut to the magnitude of what you're talking about, if it actually gets passed, I think would do more harm than good. It would probably accelerate inflationary cost push pressures. It would speed up the need to raise interest rates at a faster pace and for the Fed to increase their exit strategy. It would probably scare bond market, bond vigilantes about holding long bonds at 2.3%. you know, when we're boosting inflation. And I think ultimately would probably bring a recession quicker than would otherwise be the case. Long term, I am a total advocate of a more competitive tax structure for our companies in the United States vis-a-vis competing with the world. But I think this policy at this time is more based on politics than it is on sound economic policy.
Well, it's been another record-setting week for the market this week. Stocks going up, and the rally seems to be broad-based. Even the small-cap stocks are starting to rise. Joining us on the program is Jonathan Krinsky from MKM Partners. Jonathan, let's talk about where we are in the market today. Typically, when you get to September and October, you typically see your deeper corrections if you're going to have them for the year. We haven't had much of anything this year.
JMO, it's been pretty remarkable, but we have to remember that we're in a very strong uptrend, and that's been the case for over a year now. So, yes, it's true that August and September are historically, on average, the worst months for the year. October has seen a lot of market weakness, and there's a lot of big kind of climactic sell-offs that have happened in October, namely 1929, 1987, 2008, and of course, we're to the day when we're doing this, 10 years removed from the October 2007 top. So that was October 11th, 2007. So there's a lot of bad memories stirred up from October. But if you actually look at the data, those actually tend to be the anomalies. So if we go back the last 30 years or so, October has really only marked, you know, a major peak or the intra-year high, I think one or two times in the last 30 years. So, you know, I think October gets more of a bad rap. It actually tends to be a fairly decent month, especially when you're in strong uptrends like we're in right now.
And as, you know, one thing that we've seen recently, up until, you know, you look at the summer months, Jonathan, some of the smaller cap stocks like the mid-cap S&P index, the Russell, were not doing as well. The big cap stocks, the generals were leading the way. But if you look across all the major indexes, whether you're looking at the Russell, the mid-cap, they all seem to be in sync right now.
Yeah, that's one of the hallmarks of a very strong bull market, is that you get one group or area of the market that does well, and then that cools off, and money seems to find its way into another area of the market. So that's continuing to be the theme here this year. So the small caps, as you mentioned, they really went nowhere from December of 2016 until a few weeks ago. They made some modest upside progress, but for all intents and purposes, they were in a pretty narrow consolidation, and then again they had that big move out of that trading range a few weeks ago. So, you know, we're seeing the money move and different areas of the markets participate, and, you know, I think that's generally constructive, and, you know, that'll be one of the signs that maybe the bull market is over if we stop seeing that happen. So, you know, as long as there's rotation and different parts of the market and many parts of the market are participating, I think, you know, you have to maintain a bullish bias.
What about, Jonathan, portfolio insurance? If you look at the price of puts, there's been a lot of money spent on puts as the market has head higher. Is that usually a contrary indicator? In other words, even though the market's going higher, people start hedging and buying puts as protection. Is that just a natural phenomenon of higher prices? Or is it maybe a contrary indicator that people are getting too bearish?
Yeah, it's always tough to use derivatives as indicators for the market. We do look at put-call ratios, and generally speaking, when you see lower put-call ratios, that tends to be a contrarian bearish signal, at least for the short-term basis, and vice versa. But, you know, with the advent of so many ETFs and inverse ETFs and futures and different ways to get exposure to different parts of the market, it's become a little bit more difficult to use those as very timely sentiment indicators unless we see them at extremes. So, you know, that's what we try to do, is look for when something like those ratios really get to an extreme, maybe on a 10 or 20 day moving average basis. So, you know, we really haven't seen much of that that would suggest to us that a meaningful change is underway simply based on the amount of puts being bought.
You know, it's not just that all of the indexes, whether you're looking at the Russell, the S&P, the Dow, or the NASDAQ, are all in sync, but also for the first time this year, we're seeing the international markets participate, which have not done so in the past. So anywhere you look around the globe, it seems like stocks are going up globally.
Yeah, Jim, that's a very important point. There are so many countries around the world breaking out or already in established uptrends. But when you look at the rest of the world, excluding the U.S., and you go back to a 10 or 15 year chart, the rest of the world hasn't done anything in about 10 years. So, you know, you can say that we're getting long in the tooth in the U.S. if you count our bull market starting in 2009, which I think is a bit misleading. But, you know, if you look at the rest of the world outside of the U.S., yes, it's had a good run this year, but that's really just getting it back to where it was at the highs of this trading range we've been in for 9 or 10 years now. So, yeah, there's a lot of exciting stuff going on in the rest of the world. Over in Japan, a market that it was kind of in vogue a few years ago, but we haven't really heard much talk about it. Last night, it broke out to a 25-year high, you know, out of a trading range. So there's a lot of powerful stuff going on, not just in the U.S., but in the rest of the world.
Jonathan, what would you say would be the driver? Is it still global liquidity, or is it, for example, the IMF just came out with the story yesterday. They're upping their economic growth estimates for 2017 and upping them for 2018. Some of the best growth rates that we've seen globally in more than a decade.
Yeah, I mean, that's what's interesting, Jim. There's always seems to be a narrative, and you know, we'll leave the narrative for people smarter than us on that side of the ledger. But you know, I think the fact is, again, that markets go through cycles. And, you know, if you're talking about the rest of the world, it's just now coming out of a cycle that for equities that hasn't done anything for 8, 9, 10 years. And, you know, you can put whatever narrative you want to make the case why it's happening. But I think it's much more important, especially if you're managing a portfolio, to what is happening. And the what is, you know, there's a global breakout occurring or a global bull market, you know, and eventually those trends will stop being bull trends, but for now, they're very much in the bull camp right now.
I want to talk about another market that hasn't done as well, and that's commodities. If you look at the CRB, we just hit in 2016 and then also this year some of the lowest points we've seen on the CRB index in almost 40 years.
Yeah, so commodities also have their own cycle, right? So as a group, commodities peaked in 2011 after a pretty strong bull market in commodities. And we know that commodities tend to have very shallow and long and drawn out bear markets. And within that, you see some big rallies. But for all intents and purposes, commodities as a group, we think are just in year six of a secular bear market. So that could last another, you know, 4 to 8 years, somewhere in that range, before you're talking about a sustained uptrend in commodities as a group. Now, you know, there's going to be periods where they have strong rallies within that. You know, crude continues to act better. Brent crude broke out of a pretty nice base a few weeks ago. So, you know, there's some interesting things happening, but I think from a structural or secular perspective, it's far too early to think, you know, that commodities are heading meaningfully higher here.
Yeah, let's talk about those two commodities in particular. I'd like to talk about oil and then specifically gold, because gold is up this year. It's having a good year. Silver's having a good year as well. But let's begin with oil first. What's your take on oil in this breakout that we've seen recently?
Yeah, so we think it's a modest improvement. We have to remember that crude saw a very significant bear market from 2014 and 2016. And generally, when you have that type of bear market in any asset, it takes several years of rebuilding and base building, and sentiment needs to get fully washed out. So, you know, we're a year and a half, maybe 2 years into this trading base for crude oil. So we think it can make some marginal upside progress, but I don't think we'd be looking for anything meaningfully higher than the mid-50s in the near term. And then as far as gold, you know, similar story. It peaked in 2011. I think the important thing that we're watching is the silver to gold ratio, and that hasn't really been telling anything that favorable about the metals. Usually in strong precious metal bull markets, you'll see silver outperform gold, and we just haven't seen that. The trend, you know, has been flat to bearish for that ratio. So if we're going to see a meaningful move up in gold, I think you'd want to see silver outperform. That being said, it, you know, again, it can do okay in this environment, but I think really you're looking at the 1400 level would be the key breakout on the upside, and you know, we're quite a bit away from that right now.
So you generally want to see silver, and if it's a meaningful move, silver usually outperforms gold. What about also the gold stocks? Would you want to see them sort of confirm the move as well?
Yeah, that's a good point. With any commodity, the stocks tend to be the either outperformers in the bull markets or underperformers in the bear markets. So, yeah, same point there. In a strong precious metal market, you'd expect the mining stocks to really outperform. And, you know, there's certain ones that are doing better than others, but I think as a group, there's just not enough evidence there to say that they're in a very strong bull market here.
Jonathan, does it always surprise you as a technician, because you look at the charts, and regardless of what the fundamentals are saying, you guys look at charts, and the charts are saying it's going up, you're sticking with that theme. Does it always surprise you if you go back to the beginning of the year when you take a look at what all the experts say is going to happen to interest rates? They're heading higher for most of the year. They've headed lower, and it was going to be sort of a mediocre year for stocks. And here we are, double digits, and interest rates have done not too much of anything.
Yeah, so, you know, that's the tough part about making predictions, and that's why we try not to predict what's going to happen. We just try to recognize what is happening. And the problem with making a prediction is that you're then forced to try to find a narrative that fits it and to support it. So, you know, at the beginning of the year, it did kind of look like interest rates were maybe set to break out. But once they failed to do so and they started trending lower, you know, as a technician, we respected that. So, yeah, you have to be careful about predicting too much, you know, and really just focus on what's happening in front of you and be willing to, you know, adapt and change as the market changes.
Let's talk about some of the specific sectors in the S&P. You still have technology outperforming. You have the financial sector starting to break out. You still have healthcare doing well. Let's talk about market leadership. Where do you see the best places to be within the market itself when it comes to sectors?
So, yeah, I think you still want to stick with some of those leading and offensive sectors, the financials and technology, and those have kind of worked back and forth together. So when interest rates have been going down, you've seen a shift into growth or the technology names. And when you see interest rates start to move up, some of the value or financials have done better. But I think they can both work higher together, especially in the year end. And then you have some really good things happening in the industrials and to some extent healthcare. So I think those are the four sectors that we really like at this point. And then on the flip side, you look at some of the defensives, so consumer staples, utilities, consumer staples in particular, as of a couple of weeks ago, we're hitting 10-plus year relative lows to the S&P. So that tends to be a bullish sign for the overall market. We've seen them stabilize a little bit recently, and actually we've seen the utilities move up a little bit recently. But I think when you look at the longer-term trends, you generally want to be avoiding some of the more defensive characteristics of the market at this point. And then the other sector that, you know, has been kind of debated, but everyone's looking for the turn, is energy. We talked about crude oil a bit. You know, I think energy stocks have put in a bottom. You know, it's too early to tell if it's the bottom, but they probably need a little more time to consolidate, and then maybe you'll see one more decent move up into year end in energy. But generally speaking, I think we want to stick with, you know, tech, financials, industrials, and healthcare here.
Let's talk about utilities for a second, because the markets are doing very well. And typically, when the markets are doing well and you have the risk on trade, as we're seeing here today, you would typically not see defensive sectors do well. You just mentioned one of them, consumer staples. They picked up a little bit recently, but they have not done well this year. And typically, you would see utilities join that sector, but that hasn't been the case with the utilities. Some are saying that utilities are maybe the new tech sector, because all these gadgets that we have, whether it's iPads, phones, and things like that, it's all powered by energy.
Yeah, that's certainly an interesting concept. And yeah, utilities have acted much better than consumer staples. So, you know, I think between the two, if you're going to have some defensive characteristics, then utilities would probably be the better bet. And then even on the stock level, we're seeing some nice bases and even some breakouts in the utilities. So maybe that's the reason for that. But yeah, I think of the defensive, those utilities look a little bit better than consumer staples for sure.
So, you know, I ask this of all my technicians. Right now, everything you've talked about seems to be in a strong uptrend. All the indexes are confirming each other. The large caps, the small caps, the international stocks are all moving. If there was anything that would alert you that there were some problems out there or there's problems ahead of us, what would they be at this point?
That's funny. That, you know, the one thing that does concern us is that there's really nothing that's concerning us. So when you can't see anything, then maybe that's a reason to take some caution. But, you know, I think when you look at the breadth of the market, it actually rolled over a bit in August. It's now improved. So breadth is now improving. You mentioned international stocks continue to act well. I think it would come from the credit markets. And that's the other part of the picture we haven't talked about. But if you're looking at credit spreads, BAA versus treasury spreads, or investment grade CDX markets, they're really showing very little to no signs of stress. And typically prior to meaningful tops, you'll see credit start to roll over a bit ahead of equities. And so that's an area that we continue to watch. And again, there's no signs yet, but that could always start to pick up a little bit. So, you know, we'd watch, continue to watch breadth, continue to watch credit. And again, if those sector rotations stop happening, so, you know, if we see this shift into technology stocks again and we don't see some of the value stocks starting to participate or vice versa, then, you know, that would be potentially some warning signs. But as of now, you know, most of the checks we look at are pretty favorable for the medium term. Now, you know, again, you mentioned we're in October. We haven't had a 3% drawdown all year. So, you know, that wouldn't obviously be out of the ordinary. But for a bigger, meaningful top, I think we're going to need to see more evidence than we're seeing right now.
And is it possible, Jonathan, you know, who knows what's coming out of Washington, but the president is giving a speech on the day we're talking about tax reform. Republicans know they need to get something on the scoreboard or it doesn't look good for 2018. What impact would tax reform have on the market? Obviously, it would increase corporate earnings and if they repatriated profits from overseas. But is it possible that we could see, as strong as this market is, if things are looking good, even on the political front, we actually get a melt up into the end of the year because we are coming towards that time of the year where we normally see the Santa Claus rally. I mean, it's been a good year so far. How much better can this get?
Yeah, well, obviously, we don't know the reaction to the news, what that'll be. What we do know is that, again, it's not just a U.S. rally. It's a global rally. So there has to be something more than just U.S. policy and what's going on here. But I think generally speaking, you have to be aware that, yeah, there could be, you know, some further strength into year end. And when you have strong years and you get to October with the market at the highs, history tells you that you usually make new highs, you know, heading into the end of the year. So that's certainly a possibility. You could also have a sell the news, right, type of event where some of the small cap stocks and U.S.-based stocks have been running up in anticipation of some good news in taxes. So when if the news finally were to hit, you know, you could get a bit of a sell the news. So that also, I think you'd have to be open to that possibility. But, you know, generally speaking, I don't think whatever does happen is going to change, you know, the primary trend of equities here. So if it does lead to some weakness, you know, we would expect that to be bought. And if it follows through to the upside, then to your point, you could get a bit of a chase. But yeah, I don't think we'd read too much into what the market is pricing in for taxes.
So in summary, Jonathan, we're in a strong uptrend. It's being confirmed just about anywhere you look, whether you're looking at all the major indexes, small, large, and even globally. So at this point, your advice to investors, stay the course?
Yeah, I think stay the course. It's never a bad idea to have some cash available to deploy strategically if we get some sort of pullback, right? You know, generally speaking, you want to be buying weakness in uptrends. We haven't had much weakness this year, but, you know, that's always, again, that's a little bit of a possibility. But keep watching the rotations and the breadth. As long as those continue, then we would say, you know, you still want to be on the long side of this market.
Well, listen, Jonathan, as we close, if our listeners want to follow your work, tell them how they could do so, please.
Best way would be follow me on Twitter at jkrinskymkm.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
If you're approaching retirement age or concerned about making plans for those retired years and having adequate income, you're going to want to hear our Lifetime Income series every Monday and Tuesday here at financialsense.com. Right now, here's a preview of this week's Lifetime Income program.
Joining me on the program today is noted heart surgeon and cardiologist Stephen Gundry. He's the author of a new book called The Plant Paradox, The Hidden Dangers of Healthy Foods That Cause Disease and Weight Gain. Doctor, in the beginning of your book, you make a statement that if I told you that everything you thought you knew about your diet, your health, and your weight is wrong, you know, that's a major statement in terms of what we know to be healthy today. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, through my years of research now, looking at what I assumed were healthy foods, I realized that many of the foods that we've been told to eat are healthy are actually the cause of a great number of our problems. And in fact, Carl Sagan once said, unless we question conventional wisdom, we will never learn anything new. And I'm motivated by, there's a singer-songwriter by the name of Natalie Merchant, who wrote a song called Wonder about a child that challenged conventional wisdom. And A line from the song says, people see me as a challenge to their balance. And it looks like that's what I've become in the plant paradox. But most of the things that we think are pretty good to eat for us can actually cause most diseases that we think are just a part of getting old.
Well, since the beginning of the year, the dollars have been in a decline and gold has been on an upswing. Is this just a temporary rally in both gold and a decline in the dollar, or are bigger changes afoot? Joining us on the program from Brown Brothers Harriman is Mark Chandler. He's author of a new book called The Political Economy of Tomorrow and also author of the best-selling book Making Sense of the Dollar. Mark, let's begin with the dollar. Since the beginning of the year, the dollar has been in a decline. We've had a little bit of a counter rally here. What is driving this downturn? Is it overseas growth?
No, so it's a good question. I mean, so the dollar has had a great run from 2014, middle of 2014 or so, through the end of last year, maybe the beginning of this year. And I think what we've seen this year is primarily a profit taking and unwinding, correcting that big leg up in the dollar. What drove that correction of the dollar, I'd say two or three things. First, you know, at the beginning of this year, what it was a big fear among investors, why they sold $100 billion worth of European equities last year? Because they were afraid that the line that goes from Brexit to Trump's election was going to go through Europe. The French elections, the German elections, Austrian elections, the Dutch elections. But you know what? None of that took place. That is the populist nationalist movement did not sweep across Europe. And so April 24th is a key date for you when you're thinking about the dollar, what happened this year. The euro gapped higher. The dollar index gapped lower once it became clear that Macron was going to win in France. So the first thing that I'd say, the first thing is some profit taking after the Trump rally, a very strong rally. Fed raised rates in December 2016, like they did in December 2015, and profit taking on the dollar. Second thing, politics in Europe. Third thing is that we've had this awful thing happen in the U.S. Inflation fell. For most of my career, we wanted lower inflation, and now we want higher inflation. And instead, inflation softened up this year. And the last thing I say about the dollar is that I think that the dollar sell-off is over. I think that just like Macron put in the bottom for the euro, I think Merkel's election and all that that represents put in the top for the euro. And September, last month was the first month that the euro fell, that the dollar index rallied since early this year. And I think what we saw this past week, the dollar did slip a bit. But I think this is a correction after the big September rally. And I think that we still get a further strengthening of the dollar as the market remains confident of another Fed rate hike this year. And the ECB is likely to give us what we call a dovish tapering in a couple of weeks when they meet. By dovish tapering, I mean they reduce the amount that they buy every month, and they extend the program much longer. There's talk of extending it 9 months to a year, while the Federal Reserve's balance sheet, of course, is shrinking.
You know, it's amazing because not only is the Fed raising interest rates, and what has been, I guess, surprising, Mark, is they raised it twice already this year, but during that whole time they were raising, the dollar was declining. So now it's widely anticipated that they will, I think, what are the probabilities, over 80% that they'll raise it in December. They've already begun the quantitative tightening. And if you look at bond spreads between here and Europe, I mean, they're considerable. You know, if you take a look at the yield on a 10-year treasury, it almost looks like a junk bond when you compare it to yields in Europe.
Yes, I think it's true that European bond yields are still low, which is why I think we still see money coming into the U.S. Treasury market. Is that, and that's at the long end, but what I find is the dollar tends to be, though it's not working so great right now, but dollar tends to be more driven by the short end, the U.S.-German 2-year spread, which today got to its highest level since 2000. And so it doesn't work in a one-to-one correspondence, but I think that this is an incentive structure. You're a fund manager, you've got a large pool of capital, you're indifferent to the euro or the dollar. Both of them are strong countries, both of them have deep capital markets. So which one should you put your money in? Well, the interest rate differential give you that incentive structure. And you get paid right now, an investor, it's paid 220 basis points more in the U.S. than in Germany for 2-year borrowings. And if you're a bank and you have extra liquidity and you bring it to the Federal Reserve, right now they pay you 125 basis points. The Europeans take 40 basis points from you. The Swiss take 125 basis points from you. The Japanese take 10 basis points from you. So I think that in the big picture of things, I think these are the incentive structures that will bring the dollar back. And we have sort of like the trend is driven by those interest rate differences. Then we've got noise going around it. For example, where is it? We have tax reform. And the doubts about tax reform over the past couple of weeks looks like it pushed the bond yield from 2.4%, our 10-year note, 2.4% last week after that jobs report, down to below 230 today. And part of that, I think, is doubts about the deliverability of tax reform. And the IMF, who just gave new updates to its global outlook, took back the idea of fiscal stimulus in the U.S. next year. So it's not only just that, you know, they're forecasting the U.S. economy, but they say we're not counting on any fiscal stimulus. I think that's a lot of people in the market beginning to have doubts.
In your own opinion, do you believe that we'll get tax reform? It seems like, I guess the concern here is next year is an election year. All of the House is up for re-election. A third of the Senate will be up for re-election. And the Republicans came in on a reform and change agenda. Repeal Obamacare, lower taxes, reform taxes, infrastructure spending. So far, none of that's been done, Mark.
Yeah, no, I think that's part of the problem. And that's what I think is, there's, of course, a lot of pressure on getting something done. But I think that we'll find when you look at the, like, public opinion, not that that's the key driver here, but behind the scenes, like you mentioned, with the election coming up, I think that some people think that the tax cuts, thinking about, like, estate tax cuts, which affects a couple thousand families at the most in the U.S., or the pass-through that helps certain types of corporate organizations, the partnerships or the hedge funds. And people see that the so-called tax reform is another way that's going to exacerbate the disparity of wealth in the United States, which may be, some people argue, including the IMF, that the problem that we suffer from is insufficient aggregate demand. And adding to the tax reform shifts the money even more in that direction.
So if you were a betting man, would you be betting on tax reform or would you bet against it?
Well, I wouldn't bet on tax reform this year. I like the idea that next year is an election year and who can really vote against tax cuts. But I think that you'll find that given the skepticism about solving a debt crisis with issuing more debt, I think you find even the Democrats right now are saying no more adding to the deficit. And so I think that if it is an issue, it becomes a 2018 story. And then we might not be talking about tax reform as much as we are about tax cuts.
I'm always Larry. Anytime they talk about reform, hold on to your wallet. I want to move on to the international marketplace. And let's talk about Japan and what's going on there this week. The Wall Street Journal reported, and if anybody's been invested overseas, the Nikkei broke out and hit a two-decade high. It's something that we haven't seen in a long, long time. So let's talk about the yen. Let's talk about the Nikkei and what's going on in Japan.
Sure. So I'm a sort of a lazy economist, as you could imagine. And I find all these complicated things can be boiled down to a couple of variables. And I have something I can tell your listeners that there's one thing right now that is highly correlated to dollar-yen, record level of correlation, and that is the U.S. 10-year yield. So you tell me the direction of the U.S. 10-year yield, and I'll tell you the direction of dollar-yen. And so because in the past week, for example, the U.S. 10-year bond yield has gone from 240 down to, say, 228, dollar-yen has gone from about 113.5 down below 112. And so first thing I'd say is dollar-yen is very sensitive to interest rate differentials. Second thing I'd point out about the yen is that foreign investors have been sellers of Japanese stocks for the last several months. But at the end of September and the first week in October, they returned in a big way, buying over $2 billion worth of Japanese stocks in these past 2 weeks. I think partly the idea is that there's an election coming up in Japan. A snap election was called for in a couple of weeks from now. And if people feel more confident that Abe is going to remain in office. Partly the party of hope, the opposition party now, is not running enough candidates to unseat the LDP as the majority party. And so the market expects continuity, and continuity for Abe means continuity at the Bank of Japan, which means continued easy monetary policy while the ECB is talking about tapering. As you know, the Fed's talking about taking away more accommodation. So people see continuity in Japan, easy money, and I think people feel more comfortable moving into Japanese stocks despite the big scandal this week of Kobe Steel, a Japanese steel company that produces aluminum and other metals and has been exaggerating sort of the strength of them, the efficiency. And so And these are products that appear in cars and airplanes. And so it's been a big scandal in Japan. The stock is down over 50%. But despite that, Japanese stock market as a whole, like you say, is at 20-year highs. I would point out stock market, U.S. stocks are at record highs. The German stock market is at record highs. And despite the Japanese gains to these new 20-year highs, the Japanese stock market is among the worst performing in the G7 space this year, up about 9%.
You know, that's surprising because it hit a high, what was it, 39,000 back in 1989, and it's never been back there ever since. Who would have thought a condition in the market could last as long as it did? Almost reminds me, Mark, of the Great Depression when the Dow hit a high in October of 1929, and it would take 25 years to 1954 before it would exceed that high again. I want to talk about the international markets themselves, because if you look at this year, has been a very strong performance for most of the international markets, maybe the exception of Japan. If you take a look at the Morgan Stanley International Index, up almost 30%, or Emerging Market Index, up almost 30%. A lot of the international indexes and the ETFs up over 20%. So we're talking about records here in the U.S. and the Dow, the S&P, and the NASDAQ, but some of the records overseas are even bigger.
Yeah, I mean, I think about something like emerging market stocks up about a third this year. But we have sort of an emerging market here in the U.S. Here's how you can get 20%. Here's how one could have gotten 20% in the U.S. this year, of course, with the benefit of hindsight. The Russell 1000 has, the Russell people have a growth index and have a value index. The growth index this year is up almost 22% in the U.S. And so I think, these days with the carving out of the ETF space, there's a lot of different ways you can fine-tune. Investors, retail investors, can fine-tune their wagers. We don't have to buy all of the Japanese stocks. We can just buy, say, the dividend-paying Japanese stocks, for example. We don't have to buy all of the U.S. stock market. We can buy the growth companies or we can buy the value companies. And so I think you can find these nuggets around. But I think that the underlying idea is that stocks are going up globally. And bond yields remain low. And the idea is that there's so much liquidity in the system. And that's perhaps what those bitcoins and those cyber currencies ultimately reflect, besides the blockchain technology that everybody seems to fall in love with, that how can all these cyber currencies draw so much capital? Tells me that there's so much liquidity around. And when the liquidity is high, it hides all the rocks. People can buy things indiscriminately. And I'm just encouraging for myself as well as for others to be very discriminating here as valuations seem very stretched, not just in the U.S., but in other countries.
Yeah, you know, it's really surprising because this is what we're 9 years into this business recovery. Likewise, with the stock market, valuation-wise, probably the second highest on record. But as long as there's liquidity, I was reading this week, all of the money, nearly more than double than last year, is pouring into subprime emerging market debt. One country came to the market with a 9% bond yield, pulled it off the shelf, waited a month later, and they brought it to the market at 8.3% at a lower yield. And emerging market debt has dropped to like 5.5%, where 2 years ago it was 9%. So it's not just that valuations are stretched in the stock market, but Mark, we're seeing it also in what I call lower quality credits.
Exactly. I was at a fixed income conference recently, and that's what I think the general fear was, is that not only, like you say, not only are stocks stretched valuation-wise, but those credit quality spreads, if people are not getting paid that incremental extra return for that incremental extra risk that they have to take on now. And it's a scary proposition because you don't know whether it's safer to be on the back of the wild tiger or to jump off.
So when you take a look at this, of all the things that are out there, if there was anything in terms of a reverse catalyst that could change all this, Mark, what would it be? Would it be, let's say, the Republicans don't get any tax reform and the market wakes up to the fact that all these ideas, repeal Obamacare, tax cuts, infrastructure spending, none of that takes place? Or, for that matter, we get a spike or a sudden surge in inflation, which nobody expects. What, in your opinion, would be the spark or catalyst to reverse all of this, let's say, upside momentum that we're seeing both in stocks and bonds right now?
And that's a good question. I often think about that. What's it going to take to turn this around, or what's the big shock event out there? And I think the important thing about what happens in this kind of where we are in sort of the big cycle. And I think that when you get valuations very stretched, it doesn't take a big fundamental factor to like pop it. I think about the tulip bulb craze. It turns out, if I understand the story right, what popped the tulip bulb craze was not a big exogenous shock. It was that somebody accidentally ate what they thought was an onion, and it was a tulip bulb worth like tons of real estate. And so I remember early in my career when Gorbachev was the head of the Soviet Union, he was visiting in New York, and he got out of his car and he began shaking people's hands, and the dollar turned around. And so I think that when you've got valuations change, it could be someone sneezing. It could be some minor thing like those butterflies causing a typhoon. Those are, I think there's not like a one-to-one correspondence between the importance of the shock and the results in the market. I just think that we're at a place where there's not a lot of room to maneuver. There's not a lot of room for error. And so what happens then is when a company reports poor earnings or a country reports disappointing data, they get punished relentlessly.
So anything can trigger this. And of course, nobody right now knows what it could be. It could be a political event, something simple. It could be a corporate earnings. Or what about, Mark, the IMF just did a study released this week in terms of upgrading their international growth estimates for this year and next, some of the best that we've seen in almost a decade. But on the other hand, they also released a report of 9 major big banks, from Citigroup to Deutsche Bank to Mitsubishi, that are going to have trouble in profitability. So could it be a financial event?
It could be. It strikes me, it's very unusual for the IMF to single out individual bank names. But in my mind, it sounds kind of scary that they single out these banks. But on the other hand, the glass might be half full, in the sense that if they were afraid that the financial system was so wrong that a small little push could put it over, they wouldn't have mentioned the banks by name. And so I think the fact that they mentioned banks by name gives me a sense that they have confidence that there's time for these banks to adjust to, and policymakers to adjust to these kind of financial risks, risk to financial stability, that they were willing to mention those banks' names. It is a concern. I'd say that the U.S. banks, though, seem much healthier than European banks writ large. You know, this past week or so, the EC, the European Central Bank, passed some directives that will force European banks to begin recognizing the new bad loan situation and having to put more loan loss reserves on it to cover them.
So, given this scenario, where we are today with stretched valuations, but nonetheless strong momentum, as you've seen, as you mentioned, investors have come back into the Nikkei market in record amounts, driving the Nikkei to a 2-decade high. What would you be doing right now if you were an investor? Would you ride the wave, or would you be taking some chips off the table and maybe keeping some powder dry?
Yeah, so I am an investor. I am in my career, which means that I've been accumulating savings to help me when I retire. And it scares me this year. And for one of the first times I could think of in the last several years, I'm happy with my return this year, a little bit more than 13% in my 401k. And I decided, frankly, just to move into about 65% cash. Thinking that I could be wrong. I don't know when the stock market is going to peak, but I'm happy with my return here. I don't have to play with matches to get a return. I don't have to like tempt fate. And so I decided to like try to balance off my greed with some healthy fear. And I'll take a look at the market again towards the end of the year, early next year, to think if we had this pullback. And if we don't have a pullback, I'm giving up a little bit. I realize that by being into cash. But after a good return, that balance for me can swing back fear rather than greed. If we were at the beginning of the year, I don't know what I would do with a fresh start. But now I feel comfortable. I'm happy with my return this year. I'm happy to take some chips off the table and looking for another opportunity, which I hope comes, but I'm not sure that it will.
All right. Well, it sounds like some good advice. It always reminds me of, the picture you always see of the guy at the roulette wheel or the blackjack table. And he's got a big pile of chips and everybody's watching him. And you're thinking, wow, this guy has gotten lucky. And then all of a sudden he pulls all the chips forward, places it on one last bet, and loses it all. Good advice. Well, listen, Mark, as we close, if our listeners want to follow you, how can they do so, please?
Sure. Thanks, Jim. I have a blog called Mark to Market. Mark with a C, keeps my mother happy. And I have updates a couple times a day on big macroeconomic things, the currencies, equities, from a high level, not individual stock names. I also am on Twitter. My handle is Mark Making Sense, which comes from that first book I wrote called Making Sense of the Dollar.
And I might point out, you're the author of two books, your current book, The Political Economy of Tomorrow, and your first one, which was a bestseller, Making Sense of the Dollar. Mark, thanks so much for joining us on the program.
Thanks, Jim. Good luck to everybody.
Coming up at the next hour of the Financial Sense News Hour, the big picture, and we're going to talk about the melt-up before the meltdown. The stock market continues to hit new highs, but it's going to keep going for quite a ways before it comes down. And of course, part of that planning involves looking at downside risk as well, realizing how small a number of institutions control the bulk of the nation's deposits, derivatives, stocks, bonds, and mutual funds. That'll be an interesting topic of conversation, as well as a look at Disruptors, the disruptors. Almost sounds like a TV series, doesn't it? Those companies that are changing the face of how we do business and how we do life here in this modern world, changing things rapidly. The world 10 years from now will not look like the world does today. And an important reminder, you can join us for our investment strategy conference coming up on October 21st in beautiful San Diego, California. For more information, go online to financialsense.com, or you can call us at 1-888, this is toll free, 1-888-486-3939, 888-486-3939. Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.